Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose of Sula brings in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. Chelsea Rose, welcome back to the studio.
I'm so glad to be here.
Good to have you. This month, the digging goes full hard science with research into the effects of deliberate burning of the landscape by Native Americans more than 500 years ago. It appears to have limited catastrophic fire and had a great effect on the overall landscape. The recently published research out of the University of Utah lists Vachelle Carter. Is that Vachelle? Am I pronouncing it right? Okay. Postdoctoral research assistant. She's the lead author. Dr. Justin DeRose is an assistant professor in wildland resources at the University of Utah. Welcome, Dr. DeRose.
Thank you.
And Brian Cotting is with us as well, associate professor of anthropology. Welcome, Brian.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, Vachelle, start us off. This was some tricky research, it would seem. First, can you give it the location? Tell us where the Fish Lake Plateau in Utah is in relation to things we might have heard of.
Sure, absolutely. Fish Lake is located in south central Utah, in on the Fish Lake Plateau. It's Utah's highest mountain freshwater lake, and it's a beautiful setting, home to the iconic Pando clone.
All right, I'll ask about Pando later on because that does figure in this story, a forest growth here. So what clues were, I mean, there must have been some clues already in hand that people had been there setting fires over a relatively long period of time.
Well, actually, when we collected our sediment cores, I had no idea that the Fremont were around at Fish Lake. It wasn't until we saw this really unique period of elevated fire activity that seemed outside the norm of what a subalpine mixed conifer forest fire regime should look like that we started talking to Dr. Cotting and asking him his advice and expertise into how local indigenous communities may have impacted these high elevation fire regimes.
So, Brian Cotting, there's lots of data you needed to obtain, and then some significant issues, I think, in mapping the activities of people both in space and in time.
Yeah, absolutely. This particular project sort of came at a good time for us at the Archaeological Center at the University of Utah, because we had been collecting, working with some local archaeologists actually across the state to compile a sort of comprehensive radiocarbon database to look at how people were using the landscape through space and through time. And in this case, we were really interested in that temporal component. So we kind of collapsed space for this question and just looked at the number of radiocarbon dated archaeological sites that were occurring through this time period. And the spike in occupied sites, which some say works pretty well as a proxy for estimated population density, that really peaks around the time that Vachelle recorded this interesting prolonged period of sort of higher influx of charcoal, indicating very frequent burns sustained over this period of time that Fremont were farming in the area.
And Fremont is what we call the indigenous people today?
Fremont are an archaeological term given to a population that, of course, are all ancestors of indigenous Native Americans living in the region. And they were basically maize farming for a period of time from about 2,000 years ago to 500 years ago. And it's kind of a unique part of history in this part of Western North America, because maize farming persists in other places. Once it starts, it doesn't seem to stop. But here, it picks up and it ramps up and it goes for about 1,500 years, and then people give it up and return to hunting and gathering wild resources and plants and animals.
Chelsea Rose, as an anthropologist yourself, what is that a fairly typical thing? Does that happen? I mean, societies do an activity for an extended period and then revert to an earlier way of doing things?
Well, it's hard to tell archaeologically, of course, because we're relying on the artifacts and the things that people leave behind to showcase behavior. So it's great to bring in all these other sciences, but I think it is really unique, and it shows some extreme adaptations and innovations in response to climate change. I was lucky enough to get to visit a Fremont site in Range Creek in Utah, and one thing that was just so incredible there is you're in this I don't know, these really steep cliff faces, and way up are these corn granaries where they're storing the corn they're growing. And it's because it's such a precious resource, they have to like put it where it's not easy to steal. And in fact, some of the folks, the archaeologists that went up to take a look, had to have like full climbing gear and ropes and stuff to get to it. So, you know, there was a lot of ways that this population was adapting and responding to the social and environmental impacts of this time period, which is really fascinating.
Chelsea Rose here for this month's edition of Underground History. She's our partner from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, and we have with us guests from the University of Utah talking about the prevention of catastrophic fires potentially in indigenous times by cultural burning. Vishal Carter's postdoctoral research assistant at the University of Utah, lead author of the recent research. Justin DeRose, assistant professor of wildland resources at Utah State University. Brian Cotting, associate professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. You can join us on the exchange with your questions and comments at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Vishal, you already knew, or at least suspected, I think, that indigenous people had used fire there. Is there a new dimension to it after this research?
Absolutely. Our results really show how they were able to modify high elevation mixed conifer forests. Typically, these forests are associated with and dominated by climate. You know, they're lightning-ignited for fire events. And so to see the persistent amount of charcoal recorded over such a lengthy period of time really led us to make these hypotheses that people were able to modify the environment to benefit themselves through the use of fire.
So, Justin DeRose, are we talking about the landscape being very different from what it would have been without this level of human intervention?
Not substantially different, at least not to a general member of the public, but subtle differences in the amount of what we tend to call fuel, so what's available for a fire to burn, subtle changes in the distribution of that, can result in pretty large differences in whether you have continuous low-severity fires or very infrequent high-severity fires.
So was the cultural burning, as best you can tell in the research, more frequent than natural fire would have been?
Absolutely. So as you and your listeners know, fire is an integral part of Western North American forests, and it's been here long before people, and it will probably be here long after. And in climate strongly drives that fire, and climate's something we don't have large control over when it comes to when and how large fires are. But something we do have control over is how much fuel the fire has to burn. And one of the unique things that came out of this paper is that we essentially concluded that when these populations had built, they were farming, they were thriving, they were growing agricultural crops at lower elevations to feed their populations, and hunting and foraging at higher elevations, all of which would have been aided by low-severity fires, which they would have started almost certainly to improve forage for the animals that they hunted, and that would have an indirect effect of reducing the fuels on the forest floor. And once you do that, you have consistent fires which could contribute to that charcoal record that Michelle found in the lake, and you actually reduce the chance of large-scale fires burning. Now, over time, you will have high fuel buildup, and you will eventually have larger-scale fires, but by decreasing the fuel load really on an annual basis for many generations, you can really decrease the chance of that climate overriding and causing very large fires.
So, Brian Cotting, is there any way to know how frequently the fires were set and whether it was done to a calendar, whether it was a seasonal, annual, or semi-annual thing or something?
Yeah, we can't actually know the exact frequency, but we can imagine a situation where it's probably something like seasonal burning. People may be going up to the higher elevations and perhaps burning in the fall and spring. depending on the resources that they're interested in promoting. And also imagine burning fields in the lower elevation settings that also could be contributing to this input. One of the most, I think, remarkable and fortuitous finds that came out of this study was actually from the shell looking at the record of plant pollen that was occurring in her core that she pulled out of Fish Lake, and actually looking at those, assigning those pollen samples to whether or not they were recovered from hearth features, cooking hearths, where people were living around Fish Lake and preparing food that archaeologists have excavated and reported on. And what she was able to do is actually link that there's an increase in the abundance of the plants that people were eating during the period of time that we see this this increase in populations and the sort of prolonged period of low-intensity frequent fires. So I think Michelle can speak more to this, but I think it really ties the story together, showing that people were probably trying to promote these edible plants, and in doing so were essentially increasing the amount of food that they could feed themselves and their families.
Chelsea.
Yeah, I know in Oregon here, there was fire also was a big part of the early landscape, maintaining camas meadows and keeping open spaces like that. And I'm just wondering, in your research, it seems like fire is a useful tool for a variety of things, maintaining those agricultural spaces, keeping, you know, grass and stuff for deer or whatever you're trying to eat. And then also, I think I had read somewhere where some people would even use time fire with trying to drive animals towards where hunters were. So you could start the fire behind and try to guide everyone. So it seems like there's a variety of different ways this can be used as a tool. And I don't know if have you seen a way, like you said, maybe seasonality and stuff like that to see where it makes the most sense. But it doesn't seem like you're saying that they're using it specifically to mitigate against large catastrophic fires. That's just a bonus. I don't know who wants to answer that.
Michelle, why don't you take it?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yes, I do not think that their intent was to mitigate against climate change. I believe that they were using fire solely to benefit their population growth during this time.
All right, but that was part of it. I mean, like Chelsea's talking about, part of this was occasionally actually a herding technique as well.
Yes, we've seen that in other cultural communities. Brian can attest to that. His research in Australia does show this, how Indigenous people are able to drive fire to herd. What kind of lizard is it, Brian?
Monitor lizards. Yeah, clearing vegetation in Western Australia to basically increase the number of lizards that you can harvest. And a huge international study was done a number of years ago, Chelsea, this might be one of the things you were referring to, that basically took every society, every hunting and gathering society for which there's evidence of burning associated with it. And they said, what are the main reasons? Why are people burning? And there's hundreds of reasons. You can imagine this. Fire is such an important land management tool just to make more resources available. But the single most common use of fire was indeed driving game, whatever that game might be, from, you know, say driving rabbits towards nets or things like that. So while we don't have direct evidence of that around Fish Lake, it's certainly reasonable to think that's one of the reasons that people would have been burning.
And I wonder if you have a sense of when this shift happens, where people stop seeing fire as a tool and start being so afraid of it, like we are today, and that's led to so many of the suppression techniques that have created the positions where a lot of our communities in, where they're just ripe for a catastrophic fire.
Yeah, I think that's partially. Political history is pretty important here, because it's evident that not only were early policies of fire suppression attempts to try to reduce burning, but also honestly, negative, purposefully done to try to suppress Indigenous populations and their subsistence. And so if you stop people from burning, it's actually going to make it harder for them to make a living on the landscape. And there's examples of this across Western North America. So I think there's definitely part a sort of a dark political history that's at play here as well.
This is Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange with Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. We're talking about indigenous burning in Utah. So it's not Fish Lake as we know it in our part of Oregon, but a different fish lake, probably a lot of fish lakes in the country. Fish Lake Plateau in Utah, the scene of this research that went into the cultural burning practices of indigenous people more than 500 years ago. Vishal Carter is postdoctoral research assistant at the University of Utah, lead author of the recent research, Justin DeRose, Assistant Professor of Wildland Resources, Brian Cotting, Associate Professor of Anthropology. And you can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Mark in Merlin. Welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, good morning. Having been a student of Mark Tavescott's, one of his conclusions, I think he published back in 2007, was that, in fact, the fires intentionally set in the Rogue River area, especially the upper river area by the Tacoma, were done almost exclusively by women. In other words, it was a gender-specific task that was given to them. And I'm wondering if that compares with what they found in Utah.
Brian, why don't you take that one? Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, great question. That's another example where I think if we look across the world at the way that populations use fire, subsistence populations use fire, it is very common women's work. And in fact, in a lot of cases, women are the ones that are bringing in the majority of the food supply. I think that is going to be task specific. So if we wanted to figure that out in the past, we're looking at what might have been going on around Fish Lake. We would probably need to identify specifically what resources are people burning for and then figure out, is it more likely task specific opportunities for what women are doing or what men are doing. In this case, I imagine it's probably a combination of both, but that is a great question and definitely something that we will continue to look into.
Now, Justin DeRose, do I understand that even in drought, the controlled burning continued?
That's hard for us to tell. Unfortunately, at Fish Lake, the annual resolution of the history of fire only goes back a few hundred years, which is true in most of the western United States, because of the tree ring record begins to be depleted after a few centuries. And mm-hmm. So when we're looking at over 1,200 years like we did, 1,200 years like we did at Fish Lake, we lose that annual resolution. So it's really hard to say, based on those types of data, how frequent the burning would have been.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point to bring up, though, about the lack of tree ring data, because you just don't have trees that are that old. And that, I mean, so Vishal, it sounds like the sediment samples, the core samples, were really the heart of this data.
Yes, the paleo proxies collected from the sediment cores were very important in determining what was happening on the landscape through pollen and charcoal analysis. But it was really this multidisciplinary approach that helped us achieve the results that we did by bringing in anthropologists, dendrochronologists to help reconstruct climate to really pull all of this data together.
How squished are the layers at the bottom? I mean, are we talking like a millimeter or even less than that?
That's a great question. I believe over a centimeter, you have 15-year resolution.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So that is pretty fine. So let's talk about the PANDO. We got about 2 minutes left, and I want to make sure we get this in. But talking about what the PANDO is and how this research relates to it.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, PANDO is one of the largest organisms on the planet. It is a quaking aspen stand. And while our research specifically can't answer specifics with PANDO, it does give some insight into the benefits of fire in maintaining aspen stands. But as far as whether indigenous communities were using fire to enhance or benefit PANDO, that's just something that unfortunately our sediment records cannot attest to.
And it's considered one organism because it's a series of clones, is that right?
Yes. And maybe Brian or Justin would like to jump in here.
Yeah, in the short time left, I'll describe PANDO. it looks like an aspen forest. There's about 47,000 stems,
mm-hmm.
And each of those stems is genetically identical, so they're connected underneath by the root system. So in terms of the genotype, it's the same individual. And the above-ground part is about has been there for about 150 years, the trees that you see now. And there's been some estimates that the genotype itself has been there anywhere from 10,000 to upward estimates of a million years. That's a question we'll never know until we have a molecular clock for that genotype.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you can kind of draw lines, but can't necessarily connect what you found out about cultural burning to the pando and its promotion, its growth?
That's correct.
All right. Chelsea Rose, final thought here on trying to do prehistoric archaeology versus historic archaeology. Some significant differences there.
Yeah, I think you have different research questions and different tools available. So I think exactly what they're doing is bringing more researchers to the table, sharing data. The more lines of evidence you have, the more nuanced data you have, and the more you can really start to interrogate some really complex questions, you know, and this is just an incredible example of how much you can get done with a centimeter of soil. So good job and keep up the great work.
Our guests,
thank you guys.
Sure, good to have you. Michelle Carter, postdoctoral research assistant at the University of Utah, lead author. Justin DeRose, assistant professor of wildland resources at Utah State University. Oh, Utah State University. Didn't notice the difference there. Sorry. Brian Cotting, associate professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. And of course, Chelsea Rose from Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. The paper is published April 14th in the Nature Journal Communications, Earth and Environment, called Legacies of Indigenous Land Use Shaped Past Wildfire Regimes in the Basin Plateau region. Thank you all for being here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be here.